This is Dave Evans of HearThis.com speaking today with Dr. Susan Slovin on maintaining bone health. Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician in the Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Cancers, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine at Joan and Sanford I. Weill Medical College of Cornell University in New York City. Dr. Slovin earned her doctorate in pathobiology from Columbia University and her medical degree from Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Her postdoctoral training included a fellowship in clinical immunology through Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation, La Jolla, California, an internship and a residency in internal medicine from the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and a hematology oncology fellowship in the Department of Medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She is a member of several professional associations, including the American Association of Immunologists, American Association of Investigative Pathology, and American Society of Cancer Researchers. An ad hoc reviewer for numerous journals, including Cancer, Cancer Immunology and Immunotherapy, JAMA, Cancer Research, Clinical Cancer Research, Urology, and Journal of Urology. She also serves as a reviewer for NIH and DOD grant study sections. Dr. Slovin has contributed many peer-reviewed articles and reviews to the medical literature in the area of prostate cancer immunotherapy, with focus on the challenges of developing clinical trials with cancer vaccines. A noted immunologist who was recognized as 2003 Physician of the Year by Cancer Care, Dr. Slovin has been leading an initiative which focuses on the development of novel immunologic approaches for the treatment of prostate cancer. She was the keynote speaker at the Massachusetts Prostate Cancer Coalition held on May 15, 2008 in Boston. Dr. Slovin, unlike osteoporosis, which is common among women as they age, skeletal issues for men can be a function of advanced stage disease as well as treatment protocols. Please give us a brief overview of bone issues related to metastatic disease.
Well, thank you, Dave, for having me and giving me the opportunity to speak a little bit about prostate cancer today. You know, we talk about something known as skeletal events, and I think that can be very frightening as a terminology for patients when they hear it. We talk about skeletal events for patients who have metastatic disease, and even for patients who perhaps have issues with their bones that are long-standing. We are defining certain clinical conditions that we often can see by imaging techniques such as DEXA scans or even just plain x-rays, and very often can lead to symptoms that can be confusing. Very often, as men age in general, you'll find that many men who have been active in their youth start to develop a fair amount of symptoms that worsen over time. And in the setting of metastatic disease, sometimes it can be very confusing as to really what's causing the pain. Is it due to the cancer? Is it due to the discs that are sort of slipping hither and yon? Or is it actually due to just some bad degenerative arthritis that seems to be taking its toll? Now, clearly, one wants to discuss this with the healthcare professional, and this is where having a bone scan or even an MRI of the area is very helpful in assessing the ongoing problems. When we talk about skeletal events, we're talking about a variety of different situations that can be easily evaluated. A skeletal event is usually something that happens to the bone over time. It's true that bones from patients who have metastatic disease are weaker, that they may not be able to tolerate some very high-impact activities. Nevertheless, osteoporosis, which can occur either due to age-related changes or due to the use of chronic hormonal therapy or just to the disease itself, can actually cause some problems. So, for example, among the skeletal events that we refer to are, for example, compression fractures, and that's where the vertebrae itself loses height and it starts to compress and just fall down on itself. It's probably erroneously called a fracture because there's really no fracture or cut in the bone. It's really a loss of height and pressure on the normal interstices of the bone. The reason it causes pain is that there are underlying spinal nerves there that get trapped, and patients will have significant pain for which imaging modalities will have to determine whether or not this is due to purely problems from the malignancy, from the tumor burden within there, or just because there is significant degenerative arthritis or loss of bone mineral density due to osteoporosis. I'm very pleased to say that there are so many new ways of treating these acute situations. So for these compression fractures, more recently, even for patients who have disease in bone, is a procedure known as kyphoplasty, K-Y-P-H-O-P. PLASTY. The original use of this treatment had been in patients who had very bad osteoporosis with this compression fracture that did not have any disease. It's just good old people in the community who were older and had some loss of bone mineral. And what it's done is actually filling in or trying to expand the vertebrae with the use of some cement. And what it's done is that it has built up the height of the vertebrae again and relieves the pressure on the nerve, and it's made a world of difference for some patients who have disease that has caused the compression fracture. The second kind of clinical scenario is what we call a cord compression, where disease involving the bone starts to expand and literally puts pressure on the spinal cord below. It's easy to treat, but one has to be aware that not every pain is due to cord compression. And I often tell patients that it's better to call the office and be scanned immediately than it is to ignore it and just assume that the pain they're experiencing is due to a strained muscle or a slipped disc. So pathologic fracture is usually treated by reducing the inflammation, by giving steroids, and then radiating the area to try to kill the disease that's there. Very often, cord compressions can come back even after radiation, and surgical intervention known as decompression laminectomies can be performed to lift off that piece of bone and take it away from the area of the nerve where there's irritation. The area then gets rotted and supported with instruments, but nevertheless, patients do very well, and they're up and walking within 24 hours. A third kind of skeletal event is known as a pathologic fracture. That's where the bone has become weakened due to disease and or significant changes from lack of mineralization. A patient may suddenly develop onset of pain, or the patient suddenly is walking and trips only to find that the x-ray shows now that there's a broken hip. And that's because there's weakening in the bone and spontaneously the bone cracks. These are all very challenging entities that we have to deal with in a population of patients who have prostate cancer that's metastatic to bone, because we want to make sure, at the very least, that we are making the right diagnosis and treating it for the right reason.
There are two types of disease-driven skeletal conditions, osteoblasts and osteoclasts. Please discuss the difference in how they're treated.
The osteoblasts and osteoclasts are populations of cells within the bone. They're really not conditions per se. They're the population of cells that either make bone or dissolve the bone. So in prostate cancer, or let's say for the sake of argument, a patient has a broken bone, osteoblasts start to secrete bone matrix and try to build the bone up. Conversely, osteoclasts are literally bone-eating cells that absorb the calcium and absorb the nutrients from bone and help to dissolve the bone. When we use drugs to treat osteoporosis, such as zoledronic acid or Zometa, the way that the drug works is to bind to the matrix of the bone and hydroxyapatite and make it very, very slippery so that these bone-eating cells, osteoclasts, do not get a chance to absorb out the matrix and make the bone weaker. So everything that we do is based on trying to keep the osteoblast growing and the osteoclast at bay from resorbing. So this is not really the treatment that's, I mean, we talk about treatment to reduce the predominance of one cell type over another, but they are not really conditions. They are actually part of the bone itself and what keeps it in equilibrium.
We're seeing that androgen deprivation therapy can be a factor in causing bone-related issues. Could you describe the circumstances and manifestation of the condition?
There's a lot of data out there now that I know Dr. Matt Smith from the Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Tia Hagano from University of Seattle in Washington, have both had excellent papers that describe differences in the hormonal population of patients who are going through hormonal ablation. I'm sure many people know right now that testosterone is the driving force in prostate cancer, and that the role of hormonal therapy is really to stop the production of testosterone and to try to starve the tumor cell so that it regresses. More recently, we know that estrogen is also being affected by hormonal therapy, and in fact, there's a fair amount of evidence now to suggest that there are imbalances between the two hormones, which actually could lead to disproportionate loss of bone during treatment. Right now, I can tell you that we are going through a lot of investigations to try to figure out the best way of dealing with the hormonal changes as a man goes through the equivalent of what we call andropause, meaning the effects of using hormonal therapy with the associated side effects that you see in menopause, meaning the hot flushes, the loss of bone mineral density, the accelerated osteoporosis, the anemia, and a variety of other factors. So, and as we continue to get a better sense of how to manage this, I think that we will be able to cause fewer symptoms and fewer cases of bone loss as time goes on.
Should bisphosphonates, such as Zometa or Fosamax, be taken in conjunction with drugs for hormonal or androgen deprivation therapy?
The indication for using Zometa is actually for patients, that's the drug indication or package insert, is that for patients who have had hormone refractory disease, whose hormones have failed and have metastatic disease. Giving Zometa or Fosamax, actually Fosamax is not FDA approved for its use in metastatic disease. It's really for just osteoporosis in general, and has been approved for its use in men. There is no contraindication to using any of these with hormonal therapy, which is one of the benefits. We do have to, however, keep a good eye on people's kidney function. When they get Zometa, it has to be the dose of Zometa has to be adjusted based on the kidney function. Fosamax, you have to be very careful that it doesn't exacerbate any pre-existing symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux, and therefore we tell people to drink a lot of fluid and sit upright for at least an hour after taking the Fosamax, but they're perfectly safe to give in combination with the current indications.
As the disease progresses to more advanced stages requiring chemotherapy or similar mechanisms, what is the recommended protocol to ensure good bone health?
First thing that we always do to ensure good bone health is tell people to remain active. There's no question that when people sit around or lie in bed for long periods of time, there is resorption of bone. So I always tell patients to try to maintain as close to the normal activities of daily living as they possibly can. High-impact exercises such as jogging or doing anything that really is going to hurt the bone is not what we recommend. The best is walking or swimming or both. There's no question that maintaining good bone health means good nutrition. We never tell people to avoid dairy, although some people feel that when you say low fat, that means avoid dairy. I just tell people to have good dairy products, low fat in particular, skim milk, they can have eggs, they can have a variety of low-fat cheeses, which is very good for their overall health. But I think the most important thing is to consider the judicious use of bisphosphonates. The indication for Zometa, for example, has been monthly with treatment. However, given its long half-life, very often to make it easier for a patient who's coming in for their 3-month hormone injection, we tend to do it every 3 months. Nothing wrong with it, it's just not the indication, but I find it to be just as effective as doing it on a more frequent schedule.
Pain is a major symptom of bone metastasis. What type of treatment protocol is best utilized?
Pain is very individual. It's hard to know what is causing the pain. Clearly, if we know what is causing the pain, we would treat it appropriately. So someone who has a cord compression, we automatically would treat with steroids and radiation. Someone who has a disc problem, we might put them to bed rest or have injections of some steroids, or of course the third is somebody who has a compression fracture. Obviously we can do something like kyphoplasty. So really depending on the kind of pain you have will dictate how we would proceed with a particular treatment venue. In general, there are a lot of different pain medications that can be used. I tell patients that if they do have pain from metastatic disease, that they should not be brave and feel that they limit the pain medication. Many of them often feel that if the word morphine is used in the same setting, that that implies end-of-life issues, that they're ready to die, and nothing could be furthest from the truth. In fact, the morphine-like compounds are very helpful. They often bridge the gap where patients have not been feeling well and they can't get treatment and have made life very easy for them. So I encourage people to take their pain medication. If you don't take the pain medication and you're in pain, you lose weight, you don't eat, you don't get out of bed, and therefore you never get the treatment you need. And as medical oncologists, we rarely treat patients unless they have an acceptable quality of life, in other words, an acceptable performance status. If you're lying in bed, we can do more damage and hurt you by treating you than if you were up and about and doing things. So there are many different pain medications that include the non-steroidals such as Advil and Aleve, ibuprofen, all that whole category of drugs. There are drugs that can be used in a temporizing fashion. Once your pain is under control, either by treating the underlying cause, for example, osteoporosis or fracture, what have you, your pain medications can very immediately abate, and therefore you can still go on to do very well. So one should not be shy about using pain medications.
Again, to call back to something that you had said earlier, with the onset of pain, speak with your doctor.
Absolutely.
Are there food or exercise regimens, vitamin supplements, similar, that can be employed early in the disease stage to aid in good bone health or forestalling the progression of bone metastases?
I would say right now that there is not one particular item that can be used to forestall the progression of disease. I think clearly one needs to eat well and be strong, and I think it's important to maintain certain activities of daily living. For patients who are on Zometa, I think it's imperative that people take some form of calcium plus vitamin D. These are over-the-counter and are either CitraCal or Caltrate plus D that can be given as tablets once, twice daily. Caltrate, for example, has 400 milligrams of vitamin D and 600 milligrams of calcium. So twice a day you get more than your requirements. Again, remaining active, having a source of dairy. Most of my patients, I do recommend that they have vitamin E, selenium, vitamin E 400 international units, selenium 200 micrograms, and if you really want to, vitamin C 500 milligrams daily is perfectly fine. But I would not go the way of taking mega doses of vitamins. There have been some evaluations by doctors that perhaps it would be advisable for patients to have baseline vitamin D3 levels, which is the active moiety. I don't know that that's been validated yet. I do know, however, that most people who are on hormones have some form of a low level of osteoporosis. Whether or not it will subserve the population well to have an assessment of the vitamin D3 levels before going on hormonal therapy to see if there really is a significant underlying osteoporosis in lieu of using, for example, a DEXA scan or a dedicated CT scan of the spine is still under consideration. And I think that needs to be under the auspices of your doctor.
When should a patient move from their primary physician, either urologist or radiation oncologist, to seek the counsel and services of a specialist in managing bone-related issues?
Well, you know, Dave, it all depends on what you mean by bone-related issues. Medical oncologists are trained to deal with the consequences that occur as a result of disease progression. That includes cord compression or pathologic fractures. And when that happens, clearly we look toward our radiation oncologist colleagues or even our orthopedic surgical colleagues for assistance in managing these people. I think that if a primary physician is overseeing the care of a patient in terms of just general care prior to developing prostate cancer, clearly the primary care physician should be aware of the need for a baseline DEXA scan or CT if the patient's history points to that of osteoporosis in a family member. I think they also should be aware of the role of PSA and obviously do correct cancer screening. The urologists play a very important role, obviously, because both the urologist and the primary care physicians are the people who see the patient who presents with prostate cancer first. We as medical oncologists are often now part and parcel of helping patients with newly diagnosed prostate cancer make decisions, so we're becoming much more important as the first-line advisors. But clearly, if somebody has much more advanced disease, the medical oncologist takes the lead role in concert with other physicians. It is not uncommon for any of these physicians to make referrals to dietitians or even to orthopedists and endocrinologists for advice on bone health, particularly in the setting of a very bad family history where multiple members of a family may have experienced significant sequelae as a result of osteoporosis. So it's a team approach now. I would say it's not one doctor, but a team of doctors who should correspond and communicate and know how what each of the other doctor is doing in terms of taking care of the better good.
What are the key questions that a patient should ask relative to maintaining good bone health, and when should a regimen for good bone health be started?
Another good question. I think that a medical oncologist or urologist or primary care physician should always take an excellent and thorough family history. We should really get a sense of what are the predisposing factors toward this person developing osteoporosis. Is it a family history? Is there poor dietary standards? And if, of course, you know, has the patient been seeing the dentist frequently? Is there good oral care? Because one thing we had not talked about before, the side effects of using the bisphosphonates, which include osteonecrosis. Now, while we see more of that in breast cancer, we don't see that much of it in prostate cancer. There are cases that have been reported, but the frequency is not as high as is seen in breast cancer. And clearly, a lot of what we see happening can be prevented by good oral hygiene and follow-up with the dentist. So I would say that's actually part of your good bone health. So nutrition is very important. And what should a patient ask? Well, a patient should ask, well, what can I do or not do, doctor? How can I maintain good health? And I think good nutrition, good dairy supplementation, low-fat, exercise, and having a baseline DEXA scan or scan, such as CT scan, that's recommended by your doctor, even a vitamin D3 level, would be very reasonable in assessing baselines so that in going forward, and if there are changes in the clinical status, we have this information available. And I think, once again, I can't reiterate enough the need for the primary care physician, urologist, medical oncologist, and all the other ancillary physicians in the referral service, including dentists, need to keep in communication for the greater good.
Dr. Slovin, before we conclude today, is there anything else that you'd like to add or would like people to know?
Treating prostate cancer is really a team effort, and I think people need to understand that very often the medical oncologist, however good he or she is, can't do it alone. We need patients to be very forthcoming about the medications that they take, and that includes a wide variety of herbal supplements or nutritional supplements that are very often not perceived by patients as being medications. Many of these can interfere with the metabolism or breakdown of the normal medications that a patient may be taking or interfere with future medications. So I think it's extremely important that patients be very forthcoming. Keep in mind that medical oncologists or urologists or primary care doctors may not know all the answers. And I think patients should be very forgiving of the fact that if we can't get you the answer immediately, it doesn't mean that we don't have experience. It just means it may be something that we don't do or have not seen, and therefore we can get the answers for you. Keep in mind that not all oncologists are prostate specialists, that there are many general oncologists out there who treat prostate cancer, which may be in the minority of the cases that they see. And it does not mean, again, that they're bad doctors. It just means that they know exactly what has to be done, but not may not know the finer nuances of prostate cancer care. But trust this doctor, and it's not unusual for a patient to ask a doctor to perhaps have that physician make a referral to somebody who does a little bit more with specific targeting of their disease. So I think, again, it's important to understand it's a multidisciplinary team approach and that all together we can make a significant impact on how you do.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician in the Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Cancers, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine at Joan and Sanford I. Weill Medical College of Cornell University in New York City. On behalf of everyone at ProstateNet, thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today. Thanks as well to our listeners for taking the time to learn more about prostate health and the difference they can make in their own life for the benefit of themselves, their friends and family, and the community to which they belong. This podcast is a copyrighted production of ProstateNet and HearThis.com. All rights are reserved.